Hello, hello, hello.
Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, not yet. Oh. Hello, hello. Welcome to Real Talk Radio with Brucie and Shakira. Today we'll be discussing domestic violence, one of America's greatest concerns. I know when Brucie kind of brought the topic up, it was real interesting because, you know, a lot of people think from the aspect of domestic violence that, you know, of course we know publicly that October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, but I think with the prevalence of the issue, it's kind of ongoing, kind of an everyday, unfortunately, everyday kind of issue that needs, others need to be made aware of it. Definitely interested to hear my co-host's ideas and opinions about the subject. So first we'll start with checking in. How are you, Mr. Brucie?
I'm well. I'm excited about today's show, and I've been looking forward to it all week, actually. And I'm just glad the time is here, and, you know, we get to sit back and just do what we do and talk about what we talk about. So I'm excited for that. But what about anything, you know, new with you or anything exciting whatsoever? Or, you know, what have you been dabbling in?
I know. Nothing much. I'm real excited about the week coming up. I have some community things that I've been working on. But other than that, that's pretty much it. Just trying to make this world better one day at a time.
I hear you. So I guess we'll just go ahead and jump right into the topic. I guess that'll be the best bet for us to do. And I guess we can just start with somewhat a basic platform, if you will, on, you know, what domestic violence is. Let's say domestic and or family violence, because sometimes in many situations the terms are somewhat synonymous, but I think that as we grow and as we mature as a society, our the scope of domestic violence has somewhat become more broader. And I can't speak on many areas, but, you know, speaking from the criminal justice perspective, interpersonal relationships or that which we just look at as just boyfriend or girlfriend or just dating, those instances have now been collectively defined as or under the scope or the umbrella of domestic violence. You know, those are dating violence or interpersonal relationships and things of the sort. So that's broadened the scope of what we look at from my perspective as domestic violence. But just what is the violence that's associated in those relationships and how is that quantified? And basically any physical or emotional abuse that's directed towards an individual. And when you kind of break that down, I mean, there's multiple forms, if you will, those main categories. And there's generally five that people look at for the most part. And it's physical, sexual, psychological, emotional, and economic. But I will pose this question. And I know it's kind of just jumping kind of real quick, but I think that when we talk about domestic violence from the viewpoint of somebody that's not very, I guess, involved or haven't experienced domestic violence, the main question that so many people ask is, why do they stay? And I think that's one of the reasons why I think this topic is very important, because it's so prevalent throughout our society. And in many situations, it is a trending or a day-to-day occurrence that many people don't see themselves as actually being a victim or as being a perpetrator with regard to domestic violence.
I think it's interesting. I love that you brought up the point, because I think most people, when they think about domestic violence from the sense, we always think of the physical side or the physical aspect, but it definitely is in a multifaceted kind of issue. And, you know, in speaking to one of the the issues of staying is one of the components that you talked about, was the economic or the kind of the financial levy and lack of resources. I know we're going to skip all over the place, but I know definitely, and having worked with domestic violence individuals, one of the questions that I wanted to pose is how, in looking at some of the holds or the restraining orders, a lot of times individuals are very limited. Unfortunately, I've worked with individuals where, you know, either A, they weren't able to obtain a restraining order, or if they could, it had very limited kind of effect on the person's ability to kind of get in contact or kind of, you know, get away from the person. So I'm interested, you know, to kind of dialogue a little bit about, you know, from the law enforcement perspective, how does that, how are those laws that are simply put in place, or is it more so the enforcement of those laws that kind of pose those issues and problems?
Well, I will say that I think that when we're talking about, well, first let me premise by saying, with the scope of domestic violence becoming more broadened with regard to how do we classify an individual as a perpetrator, and are they a perpetrator of domestic violence? Because in today's age, when we respond to certain disputes that take place within a household, usually from jump, those encounters are labeled as domestic disputes, as domestic violence, due to the fact that people are in a household together. But I think that now that the actual, and generally those aren't domestic violence situations. That's just how it's quantified for the purposes of, you know, us responding, because domestic violence situations are some of the most intense and some of the most unpredictable encounters that you will ever have with people, due to the fact that it's so emotional, and there, you can have a victim that wants aid to be rendered, and then once the police get involved, or then the victim doesn't want to go forward anymore because they see the perpetrator being, you know, whether it be arrested or some sort of, you know, introduction into the criminal justice system for one reason or another. And now you have an agitated victim that's very resentful and sometimes becomes aggressive towards you because you're taking action. And I tell people when I'm talking with domestic violence victims in many cases that, you know, generally there's two, because we get a lot of time when people want to call and they just want to say, well, you know, they didn't think that I would call, so I just think that this is the first step and they'll stop and it won't be anymore. But I can't tell you on how many countless occasions where my presence elicits a more aggressive response from the perpetrator towards the victim, due to the fact that they feel as if they're going to, you know, get locked up, or now that we have an eye on them and we know about what goes on in their household, and those parents, you know, they become paranoid, those paranoid tendencies. And it's just, now I'm into the picture and I am enabling, or also are prohibiting, if you will, some of that control that they seek. They want total control. And that's one of the main tenets to why sometimes these perpetrators do what it is that they do over the victim. But just specifically talking about your question as far as the orders, here in Kentucky, like I said, boyfriend and girlfriend now, or just, you know, if we've been talking for several days, now our relationship is now quantified as an interpersonal relationship. So it fits under that tenet of domestic violence. So even in those situations, we have people that are going to get these emergency protective orders against another individual. Now, I will say that in many situations, I see those orders being abused, and that's just in our area. Now, I know you said in your area sometimes it's quite difficult for some of those victims to get those orders. And I think that there's a great level, or there should be a great level of scrutiny with regard to these orders, because you are seriously restricting an individual's rights and freedoms given by, you know, the amendments and the those constitutionally given rights. We're restricting those rights. Those individuals no longer have the ability to possess firearms under the Second Amendment. Those are taken and they're seized by the sheriff until the entire adjudication and determine whether or not this person actually committed these offenses. And domestic violence is a very serious charge if you're an employer and you're looking at something and you're looking at their history. So I think there should be a great level of scrutiny. But I think that it's a very delicate and it's a difficult job to determine whether or not that fear of imminent danger exists in a victim, or if it's, you know, if it's just sort of a retaliatory type of thing that's taken place. And it's just an ongoing battle. It's an ongoing battle as society matures or just ages and changes and things become more complex, if you will.
And it's interesting that you you talked about the kind of, I guess more so the labeling or the classification, and I definitely find that to be a bigger issue, because when we look at interpersonal relationships, a lot of the laws themselves state, you know, between man and female or, you know, whatever, when actually domestic violence, one of the actual picture that I pulled up and statistics to go with it, it occurs both ways. I mean, I look at it more so from like an intimate partner balance, because it very well could be man on man, it could be female on female, it could be mom and daughter. It just kind of more so depends on, but a lot of the laws themselves are very kind of clear cut in what they identify as domestic violence.
Well, I'll say that from our perspective, we look at, they use the word couple, and whether or not people are an unmarried couple, and are they an unmarried couple with children, or now do we have an interpersonal relationship? And we, our main goal, because I think that it's somewhat quite interesting when you look at the dynamic sometimes within a relationship when you're responding, because you can't go in with any preconceived notions, because generally a lot of people have that notion that men are generally the perps. But there are several, I guess, points that you have to consider when you're determining who is the perpetrator, because sometimes different situations, there can be different prominent aggressors, and that's the term that we look for when we respond to these situations, is prominent aggressors. And sometimes you have to look at the history of the relationship. Is this person responding so aggressively due to their past victimization, and they just have this extreme emotional outburst in response to their perpetrator over them, and it may look as if the victim is now the perpetrator, or is it something that just ignites? Because the thing about it is, there's a lot of times with words specifically, we can really push people, and then sometimes those words elicit a physical response. And now, because of our response, now we're looked at as being a perpetrator. So I basically what I'm getting at is that I think that times are somewhat changing, and I haven't seen any laws where it specifically labels a specific sex, but even, you know, the LGBT community is very dynamic when you're looking at domestic violence with regard to those situations, because there's a specific, I guess, tenet, if you will, with regard to why some of those relationships don't end or why domestic violence is so intense. You may have somebody, for instance, that hasn't come out with their sexuality, and they're in this relationship, and now a consequence of the victim deciding that, you know, they may want to tell about the domestic violence that they're enduring, well, the perp says, well, I'm going to out you. Or it could be vice versa. Somebody decides they're going to be outed, and now a physical altercation ensues. And now because of their relationship, we're looking at domestic violence as opposed to just simple assault or something of the sort. So it's an ongoing battle. It definitely is an ongoing battle. And I was actually just talking with one of my coworkers about, you know, he said, you know, why is it so different? Because in the state of Kentucky, by law, you're required to make an arrest if a victim complains of pain or discomfort. And that's the just think, you know, how, and that's very, it's very, you know, broad. Simple pain or discomfort. So how do we respond to situations where someone says, that, you know, the stereotypical, and, you know, we respond to these situations, and men always say, well, you're going to believe her because she's going to say that I hit her. And you have to do what she, because there's very limited discretion. There's very limited discretion with regard to these situations. And sometimes if you, you know, you use discretion, I mean, even in those situations, but you still have a duty to report to the Cabinet for Family or I believe it's the Cabinet for Health and Family Services within 48 hours of that response. You have a duty to report, you know, as all law enforcement and other social services individuals, they have a duty to report. And many states have somewhat similar instances, especially, you know, people in the healthcare field and so forth. But I think that it's truly deeper than what most people want to believe and what they can, conceive.
I believe so. Now I'm going to start with my controversy, because a lot of the issues come into play. I think, and I'll say, or I'll self-disclose, I know of, and personally, and I know of individuals who have been killed because of domestic violence situations. I've worked with some of the individuals, like I said, on a client to service type level, but again, also personally, and again, I question, you know, with the, what are your ideas in regards to kind of rehabilitating these individuals? When I look at it from the idea of the psychosocial model, I believe, and this is my belief, my personal belief, that, you know, the same type of monitoring as you would, not in comparison to, but the same type of monitoring that you would for someone that committed a sexual crime, it should also be done for individuals who have done a domestic type of crime, because that individual has shown themselves to be a threat or have intent to hurt another individual. So, you know, I question the ideas of how does society look at kind of rehabbing those individuals? Is it possible? Is it futile in a sense, or, you know?
Well, I wouldn't say that I necessarily disagree with something like that, but I just think that it's very, it gets very touchy when we get to extensive labeling, such as sexual offenders, because there is a registry for sexual offenders for some of those people that don't know, and there's some different areas have different time spans where you're required to be registered and to update the state police or the controlling, authority over the sexual offenders within that state, of your address and things of the sort. You know, maybe 10 for 10, 25, or even for a lifetime. But I think that as far as rehabilitation, sometimes you truly have to look at, and it gets deep sometimes, and that's why there's such a wealth of individuals that come and assist within the proceedings and adjudication to see, is this a behavioral issue that's simply due to some sort of psychological, you know, event or something of the sort, or some illness of the mentality, or are we looking at some sort of addiction? Is this, is going to be, you know, alcohol related, drug related, or are we looking at a person that seriously, they just like to exert power and control over people? But what I think is very dynamic also is that we as individuals have to become educated about certain things, because I can't tell you how many victims I've dealt with that know of people's prior domestic violence history, but they feel as if they're going to be different before even engaging in a relationship, because they look at that, and that's, I guess that's just part of, oh, well, they've changed and I'm different, you know, because of what they, it's some of the greatest manipulation that I think that I've ever experienced when you deal with domestic violence. Because when you get to a scene, and I'm sure that you can attest to this as well, a victim is going to be the irate, stereotypically, usually it's what we're dealing with for the most part. The victim is going to be the person that's going to be irate. They're going to be aggressive. They've just been assaulted. We don't know the life that this person has endured with this person, the violence that they've endured. Over the course of time, they've just been brutalized over the course of time. And now we're responding, and now you're looking at this victim that's just in a fury, and your perpetrator is going to be calm, cool, and collected. And they're going to speak to you, and they're going to have a rational, sometimes, explanation for everything. And they're going to question, what's the issue? And then, you know, why is it such a big deal? Well, I mean, what's going on? Nothing out of the ordinary has occurred to elicit my response. I just really think that it's going to get difficult to kind of look and see sometimes on why is this individual in domestic situations? Is it simply because of opportunity, or has it become of some sort of tendencies that exist psychopathically or sociopathically? I mean, what is it that's causing this person to act out in such a way? And I think that it's definitely needed, but I also think that's going to be added work to the criminal justice system, which is sometimes going to prevent. And I mean, it's a serious overhaul. It's a serious overhaul. But I mean, something needs to be done, because it's quite prevalent. It's very prevalent, and sometimes it goes unnoticed, and it goes just unseen by many because they're ashamed.
Well, and then, too, I look at it from the definitely from just the social work kind of mental health perspective. A lot of times individuals that are offenders, I should say, of domestic violence are kind of court-ordered or, you know, mandated to participate in certain types of treatment when not necessarily these are things they want to do. Now, what I can say, and I will not necessarily quote myself, but there is a correlation between individuals or offenders of domestic violence and certain mental health characteristics. Not saying they have a mental health disorder, but certain characteristics such as, you know, narcissistic personality. And it is that psychological control that they have over their victims that, you know, plays a major part of and in it. Not only just to that offender or the one that is actually, you know, committing the domestic violence, but also what it does to the actual victim. I think that's a huge part. A lot of times, you know, when you remove I've seen on several occasions when you remove a female from the actual environment where the abuse, or physical abuse, may have taken place, it does very little or to nothing to the person's psyche in regards to treatment or, you know, kind of rehabilitation for the victim. And a lot of that is because of that, the psychological abuse that they have endured. You know, essentially someone has totally capsized about what you think about yourself, you know, families are threatened and different things. Like you said, it definitely is prevalent, and I think the psychological piece is a huge piece in it, into it, on both sides, both the offender and the victim.
Well, I think that it's interesting you bring up certain, you say that there's certain tendencies that are exhibited within these individuals, because a lot of the times when you're looking at these relationships, the offenders or the perpetrators, they intrinsically feel that they do have the right to control and restrict the behaviors of their partners and sometimes, you know, there's some sort of gratification, if you will, over exerting that power. And it's definitely, you know, a type of narcissistic thing, because when you look at it, I mean, they truly feel as if their priorities, or rather their needs should have priority in the relationship, and they can do and use whatever type of tactics, whether they be abusive or not, to sort of dismantle the equality that's within a relationship. And that just causes the partners to feel even more vulnerable. And it's quite saddening, because in so many of these situations, the perpetrators or the offenders, they exert such great power and control over these victims that they essentially have nothing in some circumstances. They have nothing, and they have no place to go. And I tell you, and this is a real life encounter where I walked into, and the dynamic somewhat sort of changed, because I had a male, and he was an immigrant male that was attempting to attain citizenship here in the United States, and he was married to a woman. And interestingly enough, the woman was my perpetrator, and the woman essentially held this man hostage in a relationship over the course of time. And, you know, he worked, and she took his money, and she held his immigration papers as that was what was going to keep him there and in the relationship. But the relationship became abusive. And a lot of it has to do with, sometimes, just think of how many men out there are victims of domestic violence that aren't going to come forward because of emasculation. And they don't want to feel as if, it may be even in those relationships where there are, actually, you can look at it from both issues. If we're talking about a homosexual relationship and there's male dominance over male, there's still that those tendencies for men to not want to become, or not to label themselves as, a victim. So how many times do we not get called, or professionals not responding to those situations due to that?
I think it was interesting when I pulled that statistic and it said 1 in 14. That was alarming to me. You think about it, but you're right. And I think not even just for the male to female or male to male, but just in general, I think a lot of the not necessarily why the issue continues to be so prevalent is because of the societal norms in which it exists, you know. And the same as males don't want to be demasculated, females don't want to be seen as weak or, you know, as, you know, are victimized in a sense for it happening. And a lot of times, is it really true in America? Do we have an open space where somebody can report something and, you know, feel protected and not feel criticized or not feel judged by, you know, peers and or agencies that they are seeking help from in regards to domestic violence?
Well, also, I think that there has to be a true will to want things to change. And it's individuals that are attempting to render aid. I mean, it's not like, because when you truly want to help somebody and you're there and you're trying to utilize the resources at your disposal to gain, to give this person some sort of security and to aid them in moving forward, we have to truly have a victim that is 100% with us with regards to going forward. And I don't know if you dealt with, you know, individuals, I mean, because individuals recanting their statements, and that's why, especially in a lot of states, domestic violence is one of, if not, you know, I would say it's one of the very few crimes or the most prominent crime where the Commonwealth or the state, they become the victim. We don't need a victim's permission or we don't need them on board to prosecute and go forward with the case, because sometimes that power and control is so great that by the first court date, you no longer have a victim. Now they're back together. And in some instances, I've had an unmarried couple that has lived together for some time that have become married before, you know, actual adjudication of the charges. So what we do in those situations? And even in front of jury, sometimes it looks very, it's interesting to a jury, because the jury they're not sure which route to go. Is this law enforcement professionals just putting charges on people and labeling people as domestic violence abusers? Or is this somebody that's seriously in need of, you know, aid, and now they're changing up their story? So it's an ongoing battle, because we have to have – the statement's always there, but it's, in this situation it's kind of weird. But they say you can't help somebody that doesn't want to be helped. But to what extent do they want to be helped? And that's where and that's sometimes when I'm on scene, when I'm dealing with victims, I ask them, how can I fix this issue for you? What can we do to move forward to better your circumstances? And sometimes you just get simple answers like, well, I just want them to leave. And sometimes it's usually not that simple. It's not that simple at all. Because I'll tell you, you know, I said, we got two chances here. My presence is going to solve this issue and cause it to no longer be in existence, or it's going to make it worse. And from my experience, generally it makes it worse. So that's kind of what we're dealing with in a lot of situations. And that's why I think that it truly takes a collaborative effort from many individuals to truly see what the issue is and get some people the true help that they really need.
I think so, because I think honestly with some of the individuals that are victims, they don't even, I mean, from a counseling perspective, they're not even in a appropriate state of mind to make the decision. While they may recognize the signs and the symptoms and the actual being in the abuse, but along with, you know, experience domestic violence, you've also experienced trauma. And anytime that you introduce the idea of trauma, you know, things like PTSD come into play. And, you know, when you're operating with those, you know, kind of things on the forefront, or you're operating in the realm of those things, you're not making appropriate executive decisions. You're just not.
Right.
You're making decisions from that state of mind. I did, before I lose my thought, two things I thought about when we started talking about this topic, or when we brought it up. And one of the things I thought about was, it's interesting, and no tea, no shade to any public celebrity, but I thought about the Janae Rice. She recently announced that she was pregnant again with Mr. Rice's baby, and we all publicly saw what happened in that dear elevator.
Correct.
And, you know, so in a situation like that, while I, you know, it is my utmost prayer that she never experiences anything like that again, but, you know, how do we as a, you know, as a society address that, or, you know, how do we look at that? Or,
well, I'll pose this question to you, and this is one that I thought about. Do you think that do you think in some circumstances a domestic assault could truly be a snap of the moment accident and just some sort of irrational, I won't use the word reflex, but I'm going to say something to where a person just in the moment becomes so emotionally disturbed that they act out physically, and those aren't truly there. Because as we're talking about, in this situation, we're truly talking about these people that have these, and I'm going to use a word that I know a lot of people don't like, but they have these abnormal tendencies to want to exert that power and control over people, and it's systematically they deprive people of their freedoms and things of the sort. But can we truly look at in some situations as true accidents of improper control of anger or some sort of high emotion?
Absolutely not. I am not here. Under no circumstances do you accidentally invoke, unless you're having some kind of psychotic break or some kind of psychotic or mental health issues, like you kind of noted or alluded to, which that would have been predetermined prior to the point of hopefully you putting your hands on somebody. But under no circumstances do you put your hand on somebody and that become an accident, or that is not done with intent, particularly in the realm of domestic violence. When someone is out to get you, and that's kind of my thing, and that goes into a whole bunch of things, there's a difference between, you know, intent and what is, you know, to be implied. If you are putting your hands on me or doing or saying things in a manner in which are aggressive towards me, then that is with intent. And with intent means you have purpose behind it, and it means that you ultimately are out to cause harm. There's no accident into that. Like I said, under certain circumstances, if somebody was inebriated and, you know, that then they became aggressive or different, that may be different. I don't know how that's classified in the law between assault and domestic violence, but point blank domestic violence, I don't believe there is no accident in that. You know, no one has the right to put their hands on anybody intentionally.
True. My main... The reason I just posed that, just playing the devil's advocate, is because, as I said, we're dealing with a very serious issue and with the issue comes along serious labeling, if you will, with regard to the criminal justice system and just history as being a domestic abuser. On a daily basis, we deal with, you know, arguments that turn into, you know, people wanting to leave and people not letting them leave. And then you have a person that's pushed and they fall to the ground. And, you know, now they're in pain and they want the other person reprimanded with regard to, you know, an arrest or something of the sort. So I think that it's real interesting when we're dealing with people that feel as if they have the ability to resolve conflict in a mature manner, but then the situation escalates and there's some sort of action that takes place, that now we're looking at a criminal type of situation. Another story for you from just actually a couple of days ago. Married couple, two females, relationship, about 10 years, 10-year relationship. They're married, and they've been, I guess, separated for a slight period of time, talking on and off, but there's some sort of infidelity issues as far as one another moving on and wanting to talk to other people. Well, one of the individuals is inside and becomes agitated with the other because she's moved on. So she accosts her and, you know, puts her hands around her throat and put her up against the wall, and then strikes her in the face a couple of times. Well, one thing led to another, and now the perp gets outside of the dwelling where she once lived, but she moved out, I guess, a couple of months ago. So the victim won't let the perp in. So the victim says, well, I'm going to call the police if you don't leave. Perp doesn't believe the victim. So the perp goes around to the side of the building and turns off the electricity to the house. Perp comes back and says, well, now what are you going to do? Victim doesn't give in. Perp continues to try to get through the front door by attempting to push into the door with her shoulder extensively, causing visible damage and quite extensive damage to the door and to the door frame. I arrive on scene. Oh, and also, before the perp exited the house, she took two phones from off the table that didn't belong to her because the victim wouldn't give her back her phone. So in this situation, under the law, I'm dealing with, how do you handle a situation like that? Well, the perp just says, well, I'm just going to leave. And the victim says, well, I just wanted to leave. By me calling the police, she knows that I'm serious. Also, keep in mind, there were five children upstairs that were asleep.
Oh, my goodness. No ma'am.
Four of them being the children of the victim from a husband in a prior relationship. So now we're dealing with these two people that irrationally handled their sort of dispute, okay? Now, the perp says that she used force to try to get back into the dwelling or the residence or whatnot to get her phone because her wife wouldn't give it back to her. So due to that happening, she took two phones off the table, one of them being her wife and her wife's friend who was also in the house when this happened. So I don't know what many would do in response to that situation, but under the law, that's a burglary. Unlawfully entering or remaining on a premise being a building or a dwelling with the intent to commit some sort of crime. So you use force to get through a door which doesn't, you know, belong to you in order to go in and get your phone. So, and also, what's also interesting is the dynamic of the situation, that it's quasi-criminal because we're dealing with the civil aspect as well. Because as far as property distribution, you're married under the law. There is no division of property until you all go your separate ways, and that's ordered through the court. So, in a situation like that, you know, it's just real interesting. And it's very dynamic, if you will, because the perp felt as if she truly did nothing wrong. But I said, you know, she said, well, burglary, that's real serious charge. And I said, well, you know, burglary is serious, but who's this? I don't know what would have happened if you would have made it through that door. And I said, you have to seriously think that also by preventing or inhibiting or hindering someone from gaining assistance from a law enforcement professional, that's a serious crime as well. That's a felony.
Wow. And you see, I look at it from the social work perspective, because like the first thing you said, where there was, you know, children in the house, and, you know,
right.
both both the perp and both the victim, you know, thinking about it from the sense of endangerment for those children, because either one of them could have been in a situation where either, you know, children come downstairs, children are exposed to whatever else is going on. And I think that, but again, that's just my perspective from a social worker. I always think about the kids. That definitely would have been a CPS concern.
Well, I mean, it's I guess with this situation, CPS is going to get involved. As you know, the paperwork that we do as far as domestic violence paperwork, they're always notified and they'll follow up with these things. But I just, the reason why I brought that story up is it's just to go back to sometimes how I think that over the course of time, it seems to me, it's just my opinion, that we as individuals have truly become, how would I phrase this? We become unable to handle conflict as we should and deal with some of the things that there's a lack of ability to handle conflict, whether that be within ourselves or just in life. There's these skyrocketed percentages of people with depression from life circumstances that once upon a time, you know, did people just deal with them? Or were there people that were undiagnosed with depression in the past? So are there people that seriously, you know, do we deal with these from a medication aspect? Because there are certain, levels of neurotransmitters that are out of whack. Or are these people that just need to find methods and ways to deal with the issues that they experience on a daily basis? As today, you know, the reason I always say is that now, if you look at it, so many people we look down upon people that are hurt, that become hurt or saddened, but we like anger and rage. Those are respected. We don't look at people that are anger and rage to be weak, to be bothered. They're handling their business or they're dealing with their issue in a method which is honored or respected or it's not looked down upon but it's not something that we turn a blind eye to that. But when somebody's, you know, saddened or weakened by a situation, they are weak or they are looked down as being inferior from one issue or one viewpoint or another. But I think that's kind of – that raises questions a lot. And I think that has a lot to do with, like we talked about in past shows, the propensity towards a lot of this violence that's going on, because it's the inability to handle a lot of conflict that comes up. You know, you shoot somebody because they step on your shoes or because they call you the wrong name, you know, by accident, and now you have this serious dilemma with them and you go forward and try to take this person's life because they quote unquote disrespected you. So, I mean, how do you feel about that?
I think, you know, honestly, it's interesting that you brought it up, but we do. We live in a society where there are no societal norms that support conflict resolution. Like, I remember clearly in grad school, one of my thickest books was my book on conflict resolution, and it had so many great ideas about things to use, and I probably have looked in that book on how to address issues. But societally, there's nothing to support effectively gaining or utilizing the appropriate coping skills. Why? Because we live in a society that says you have to be more, you have to be better, you have to be prettier, you have to be thinner. So naturally, in order to do those things, sometimes you don't go through the natural proper channels, be it emotionally, spiritually, physically, growing on how to deal with and cope with those things, you just want it. It goes back to what we talked about, you know, several kind of overlapping in several, you know, our shows where we talk about the instant gratification piece. And I think when you relate that to domestic violence, it is that power, that wanting to instantaneously control someone and control their, you know, their psyche or their thinking, that you feel as though you have to physically, verbally, financially, whatever it may be, exert that upon another person. And when you don't do so, we see the high prevalence of domestic violence or and or intimate partner violence.
Well, I'll tell you this, and this really intrigued me. And it says, the guarantee of safety in a battering relationship can never be based upon a promise from the perpetrator, no matter how heartfelt it is. Rather, it must be based upon the self-protective capability of the victim. Until the victim has developed a detailed and realistic contingency plan and has demonstrated their ability to carry it out, they remain in danger of repeated abuse. And I think that that truly sums up a lot of the perspective of many people in the criminal justice field. Because you cannot compel somebody to become a victim. You can't force them to become a victim. It's not illegal to be a victim. It's not, you know, it's not something that we can't, you know, lock you up and take you away and hold you, you know, because you're a witness to a crime in a lot of respects. And when I say the word witness, a victim is synonymously the same as a witness. I mean, I'm sorry, a victim is the same as a witness. They're the actual complaining witness, if you will.
Gotcha.
That's bringing forward the complaint against the suspect. But, and I think that's what we have to kind of look at that, because how do you compel somebody to become a part or to do things that you feel are best? You can't do that. You can't take somebody against their will and put them in an environment or cause them to go forward with something that they feel isn't the best for them. And I think that that's part of the ongoing battle as well with domestic violence, is because the victim truly has to see that the life that they're living, there are issues within it, and that they have to want people who are in the position, and they have to look at those people that are in certain positions as people that can help them over and being greater sources of, I guess, power than their actual perpetrator that's acting over them with regards to the power and control. And that's an ongoing battle.
I agree in the sense of self-accountability, but I also agree or, you know, highlight the sense of I'm always for creating environments where people can do those type of things. And realistically,
correct,
working with women, and I only speak from the standpoint of having worked with domestic violence women and understanding the like I said, the resource and kind of the social work, psychosocial side of it, a lot of times the environments are just not there. It's hard to tell a woman who, you know, although she may be in a physical, have experienced physical violence, you know, hey, leave that person when, you know, your kids are reliant on it. This person has control over, you know, you, your finances, where you live at. And then to tell them, well, you know, not only do I expect you to give that up, but I also expect I'm going to put you in an even more uncomfortable situation. Yes, do I believe personally? My value and moral system tells me I'm going to do anything for the sake of survival, but some people just don't have that, you know, that kind of ability or, you know, that kind of reasoning to make those kind of decisions. Unfortunate man's bill. But, you know, I do say in the sense of domestic violence, continuously continuously telling people that it's okay and they can speak out on it, and continuously encouraging those people to, you know, not necessarily be in those situations, but more importantly, offering them the support, you know, whether they do or don't. And I feel like a lot of times when it comes to domestic violence, it is kind of a do or you don't, you know. Everybody supports you when, like, you know, if you decide to leave the person, but if you don't, it's kind of, well, a hands-off situation. We'll wait to see what happens. Well, really, domestic violence in itself is a process. It's a cycle, so to say. And sometimes, you know, breaking that cycle means you kind of got to go around the loops a couple of times. So it may not be something instantaneously that a person removes themselves from. It may be a couple of times of, you know, hey, okay, this keeps happening to you. What can I do? How can I support you?
You know, and also I will say that I think that's why there's so many there's people like domestic violence, like victim advocates, that aid the people or that aid victims in understanding the process of the criminal justice adjudication and how the case is going to be handled. And they see what resources the victim needs in order to go forward with the actual prosecution of the case. But as you brought up the cycle, and I think that also is what a lot of victims experience, but they don't understand. They don't think about it. You know, you don't understand why things get better and then something happens and they blame themselves as, oh, you know, well, I messed up. I came home late. Everything was going good, but I came home late and then it went back bad again. You know, and that's why all this is happening. And then everything goes good again. And then I didn't tell them where I was going or who I was with. And we've gotten to the point now, as things have changed, is we assess a lot of these situations for lethality and to see the likelihood of the encounter of a victim and a perpetrator becoming lethal. And sometimes that gives you this, somewhat a foundation to kind of work forward to see how serious, well, it's always serious, but how, what exhibiting factors are there that are visible within the perpetrator that lead us to really solidify that this is a true issue and it's something that needs to be dealt with, and there may be some pre-existing, like psychological, as we talked about, situations that are there. But when we're talking about these perpetrators that, you know, that they're threatening suicide or homicide, or they're always in possession of weapons, or they have the ability to easily obtain weapons, specifically that of deadly weapons, whether it be guns or other non, like household type of weapons, like just knives that are there. And then when you're looking at things like ownership type of things, when a person says that you quote unquote belong to them, or that the only way that you're going to get out of a marriage or relationship is by death. You know, either you're going to be with me or you're going to be with anybody. You're not going to be with anybody else. And then sometimes if people escalate, and that's where I think that, you know, that conflict resolution that we talked about, I always tell people before things, and I know it's sometimes hard, but in any situation where you feel as if you are, so you have to know your limits. And when you feel as if you are unable to cope or deal with that conflict, walk away. There is a great preponderance of people that feel as if they're big boy or big girl enough to deal with the situation, and then God forbid something happens that is truly life-altering, whether that may be criminal or just health-wise, an assault that elicits, and once actions are carried out, you cannot take those actions back. And if you feel that you can't handle a situation, you need to call somebody, you know. And like I said, I know very many people are hesitant on calling the police in certain situations. But when a situation goes, you know, astray and it goes downhill very quick, fast, and in a hurry, our presence is going to be elicited anyway. So let's prevent things. I like the whole aspect of my job as far as I like to prevent crime also as far as, you know, I don't want to also just always be reactive, but I want to be proactive. I want to provide knowledge, provide resources, and to aid people. Well, number one, just aiding the relationship and bettering the relationship with people within the community, because I think that that's truly one of the main tenets of community-oriented policing, but to also not only be there when bad things happen, but kind of prevent those things from happening. But people have to be able to recognize, and I think that's where, I mean, we're placing accountability, more accountability on people in order for them to do so.
Absolutely, I agree. I mean, one of the big things out, you know, in looking at domestic violence that I think about is, you know, start looking for those warning signs. And, you know, I say to start looking for those warning signs when, you know, people, when you're dating a person or sometimes just in your friendships with somebody, you know, is a person a little too controlling or, you know, questioning or untrustful. And, you know, we have to not only just look for those things, but we also have to act on them. You know, I'm a firm believer in the moment that somebody shows you, I believe it was Maya Angelou that says, when somebody shows you who they are, that's who they are. You know, so
believe them. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely believe them. So in looking at those things and those signs, when you're interacting with a person, it may be a potential mate. I feel like a lot of times, you know, on the preventative side, not to say you necessarily can prevent because they are crazy people and they do crazy things, but in the sense of, you know, guaranteed, if you look at a lot of cases of domestic violence, somewhere down the line before this person physically went to the act where they physically or verbally acted upon something, they gave some kind of either via, you know, some behavioral cue that, you know, something wasn't quite right or something was going to occur. And, you know, as individuals, we have to, you know, we have to adhere to when people show us those things. We necessarily, I tell my clients over and over, it probably should be written on the wall. You know, I cannot control other people, but I can control myself. So that means I control who I allow in my life, who I allow to influence my life, who I have interactions with. And it applies to, you know, my intimate and romantic relationships just as well.
And I'll say this, it's a very interesting contrast with regard to vulnerability. When we're looking at a healthy relationship, vulnerability is a good thing. Because oftentimes bonds become closer and in with regard, you know, that intimacy is there. And it's not just necessarily, you know, in very, you know, sexual intimate relationships, but people become closer when you become more vulnerable, you open up and you become more apt to release things and truly display, you know, what it is that you feel and things of the sort. However, when we're talking about, and also in those situations, when you, let's say you do become hurt or something of the sort and you're open, that gives the other individual the ability to know what's going on and to be able to make those amends or to see how you all can move forward. It's really important to let people know how you feel and things of the sort. However, when we're talking about this whole abusive system and the domestic violence situation, vulnerability is something that's very dangerous because it further causes that person to be exploited by the aggressor. And, you know, sometimes abusive people will feel a surge of power and whatnot when they see that vulnerability and that weakness. And it just confirms that they're doing the right thing and that they're, you know, moving forward with regard to their goal. And it just further emphasizes the point of why we truly have to be very cognizant of the type of people that we are engaging in. Because you know how people say that you are the company that you keep, but it gets more intimate within that because you become involved in things and placed in certain situations, and it causes your views and just your world, your environment to change.
Absolutely.
And some of these people, they get in these domestic violence situations, and that becomes their world. And they know nothing different. And that's what's truly saddening in a lot of these situations, is because they see no light at the end of the tunnel. They see no resources or no powers that be that can aid them or help them overcome what they're experiencing. And I think that in that situation, that is the ultimate loss. That's the ultimate failure with regard to what it is that so many people are attempting to change or affect in a positive manner.
And I think too, and I didn't highlight on it, but like I said, as a person that has witnessed someone have their life taken at the hands of a domestic violence situation, I also charge friends and family to have that offer, that continued support, and that, you know, that continuous assessment. Because a lot of times, like you said, when you're in a situation, you don't necessarily see all of the dynamics within that situation. You have your own perception. You have your own altered view of, you know, that relationship or that individual. And sometimes it's, you know, those outside views and opinions that, you know, really are more realistic, you know.
A true support system truly is important. Because especially from those people that you feel that you can truly trust and that were there prior to the relationship, because they're so, that when that power comes over certain people and they become in those relationships for a certain period of time, they feel that when people try to come between that relationship, it may be jealousy or so many other factors or why the person may appear to be concerned. But these situations go awry so very quickly, and that's why domestic violence is so it's so sensitive. Because what we look at is sometimes being a simple assault you can't just turn your back and part ways with somebody that easily that you've been in a relationship with. And I mean, it's an ongoing process, and sometimes people don't know what steps to take in order to deal with a lot of the things that they're experiencing. So I just really think, you know, that's why people like you and I are here, to kind of not necessarily tell them what's best for them, but just to reassure them that there are better options out there, and that nobody is deserving of being in a situation where they're systematically and continuously abused and demeaned and denied just freedom. You know, it's quite saddening that so many people are just held captive of their own identity.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, like I said, anything, we can't necessarily make people engage in resources or services, but, you know, what we can do is empower them. So, you know, I'm always here for empowering somebody that, A, they deserve better, or, you know, it can be better, in the sense where, you know, they don't necessarily feel like they need to continue in a situation that is not healthy for them. Physically, emotionally, financially, whatever it may be.
Well, Shakira, we have a call that's calling. I think that wants to chime in.
Okay.
On the topic. Alrighty, caller, are you there?
Hello.
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 Welcome,
yes.
Welcome.
Can you hear me? Hi.
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Okay. Very good. I would like to say that I feel that domestic violence, if once it's detected, if there are some options for if you see a child, a male child or female, child that is aggressive with their siblings, and if they have a history of domestic violence in the home, whether it be the father, grandfather, or whatever, if that is addressed, then sometimes it can prevent that child from growing up being aggressive, you know, or in domestic violence. If they are, it's addressed then, you know, for you know, to the child, you know, that this is not, you know, proper, or that there's another way of dealing with aggression or anger.
You know, ma'am, it's very interesting that you bring up that topic because on so many occasions, a lot of people, you know, a lot of these instances that we encounter in society are learned behaviors. And that when you see these situations take place on a day-to-day basis, it becomes ingrained, and it looks as if it's something that's normal, or it should be. These are actions that should be expected from a father or from a mother, and you feel as if, you know, intrinsically, that this is what I need to do once I grow up. And that's something that we really didn't touch on today, but I think, you know, you can touch base on it too, like as far as just people just being, formed or cultured, if you will, they're developed to carry out certain behaviors and actions because they feel that that's what they have to portray in order to be, you know, like thy mother or like thy father.
Oh, absolutely. It definitely kind of resonates on the idea of the nature versus nurture concept that, you know, naturally, if you're born into, that's not to say for every circumstance or situation, but if you are a victim or have witnessed someone be a victim of domestic violence, you do have a high risk of at some point exhibiting that behavior at some point, be it, you know, not necessarily domestic violence towards your partner, but it may be such as the caller said, as a high level of aggression. So, you know, definitely that is one of the questions when now, which I'm grateful for, over the last years we've had a shift in primary care doctors have started doing domestic violence screening. And those are some of the questions that are asked, you know, have you or yourself witnessed, not experienced, but also witnessed domestic violence, verbal abuse, or et cetera.
And what I also think is real dynamic as well is that in the early stages, as far as, you know, in childhood and things like that, if domestic violence is in a household, I feel as if it's very important to eliminate and to challenge and deal with those situations, because in the future, when these adolescents grow and manifest and they begin to carry a lot of these violent tendencies, at that point, how do we – I mean, it's an ongoing cycle, and a lot of times you have to deal with their culpability in a lot of these situations because, you know, when we look at certain – I mean, they feel as if they're expected. I know ignorance of the law is no excuse. However, there are people that have, over the course of time, been conditioned and trained – through their life experiences, that this is what's expected. That doesn't make it right, but I think that it explains, if you will, why a lot of these situations are and why a lot of these tendencies are possessed. And that is what's truly going to aid us in going forward and rehabilitating and providing the resources that people need to deter those actions and behaviors.
But thank you. Thank you to the caller for highlighting that.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Because that's something that we didn't consider, but it is, I mean, it's very prevalent. And that's why, I guess we kind of touched bases on as far as the children being in the house, during that incident, and Child Protective Services somewhat following up. But as far as just how prevalent that is and why a lot of this happens, it's definitely important to bring forward and to recognize and to deal with. I mean, when it is noticed and it becomes a part of our reality.
Hello, caller, are you still there?
Yes, okay. I'm just listening.
Oh, okay.
And I'd like to say thank you very much for listening to my opinion.
Oh, no problem at all. No problem.
Thank you for calling in.
You're quite welcome. And I've enjoyed your radio talk time. You touch on some interesting subjects, which is great to bring out to anyone that's listening and hear various opinions and also facts.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I know I do. I'll challenge you with this question. What do you think are some of the, I guess, characteristics of a healthy relationship?
Well, basically, it's communication. You know, if you can talk to one another about anything, you know, from anything at all, from leaving the toilet seat up to throwing socks on the floor, not making your side of the bed. It starts with minor things. Sometimes we get into the hardcore things, you know, like how much he makes, what does he do as occupation, how does he look, you know, will my girlfriends like him, you know, but none of that matters if you don't get along with one another. You don't communicate with one another. If you don't trust one another to tell each other anything and not feel like the relationship is going to be damaged or, you know, come to an end. If I feel threatened and I'm not comfortable enough to tell you, you know, my secret because I feel like you're going to leave me or, you know, or you're going to think less of me, then that makes it unhealthy, you know. It's like introducing different foods to your body. You know, you have to try something before you know if it agrees with your system or you know, you introduce things. And in a relationship, you have to introduce different things, different matters, you know, in order to know whether or not it's going to work long term.
And I'll add a caveat on to communications. I definitely agree. I think that's truly number one. But I would also say boundaries, because in so many situations, you know, jealousy comes into place and other characteristics, in that relationships, both partners need to also sometimes have, I guess you would say, senses of individuality in a sense, or just as far as allowing each other to spend time with friends. And then especially with many newer generations, abusing technology, if you will, to check on partners and to delve into their everyday and minute-by-minute actions, because that's sometimes what's going to cause many thoughts and sometimes feelings to manifest that may elicit some sort of response that may further be, you know, aggressive or challenging. But I definitely agree with you on communication, and I think that in a lot of these domestic relationships, it's a one-way street because of that power and that control that's there and that exists. And we have to be looked at as equals and not as one person being over another.
And in communicating also is like you said, knowing one another's boundaries. If you know that that is a trigger with your partner, that you hang out with your friends all night, or that you check their Facebook, or that you come by their job at lunchtime, and that's a trigger that upsets that other person, then, you know, then you communicate that, well, look, you know, you keep coming by my job and, you know, like you don't trust me, or, you know, I saw you was on my Facebook today, you know, was there something you were looking for, or, you know, and if I don't, you know, like such and such and such, and if I just build it up and build it up, you know, and it leads to anger, and I am a borderline, you know, domestic violence person, or, you know, when I get angry, I'm physically agitated, you know, then, you know, you should know those things, you know, straight up in the relationship, you know. If I don't like you leaving your dirty clothes all in the middle of the floor, and that really upsets me, and I just do it for 2-3 weeks, and finally I've had enough, so I want to throw a dish at you, you know. Just, you know, I didn't communicate with you that I hate when you leave your clothes in the floor. I hate when you leave your dishes in the sink. I mean, communication is just the groundwork of a relationship and anything else, really. Even on a job, you know, getting a position, you know, sometimes we don't get put up for promotion or something because we haven't showed that we really want another position or we want to do better, you know, at that job. Or, you know, communication is just the groundwork of just about anything.
Absolutely, I agree.
I'm right there with you. So before we depart, I just want to slightly touch base on some things that people can just think about to evaluate their current situation or just even future situations to kind of see, are you in a situation that's highly likely to possibly become an abusive relationship, or are you currently being abused? And it's just small things that sometimes that we take for granted that we really don't think about. But, and sometimes we're not just speaking just about single things, but sometimes the totality of a lot of the acts or the feelings that come about. And some of those things just simply be, you know, being embarrassed or made fun of in front of friends or family, or are your accomplishments put down and your goals not recognized? Is intimidation or threats used to gain compliance? Do people tell you that you're nothing without them, or treat you roughly, or blame you for how you feel or how you act? Is like, do people get into certain situations and blame alcohol or certain drugs as far as, you know, why they told you what they felt or why they hurt you? Do people prevent you from doing things that you want or make you feel like there's no way out of the relationship? And then if you even look at, you know, sometimes, do you sometimes, like, feel scared of how your partner acts, or do you constantly make excuses to other people? And that's one of the things I really want to touch on, that I really like. A lot of people will justify their abuser's actions to others that are concerned. And, Shakira, that's where we were talking about that support system came in. And
Absolutely.
There needs to be a certain level of self-recognition and accountability in the situation as well, that goes to that person actually recognizing that there is an issue and that they need to do something to move forward and be able to allocate those necessary resources in order to do so.
Absolutely. And again, you know, like you said, you know, just to, in closing, it is important that, you know, the first step is talking to someone and recognizing that, you know, as an individual that, you know, you deserve better or you can have and will have better, you know, other than the kind of maladaptive relationship that a lot of times individuals that have experienced that domestic violence incur. But definitely, you know, love is not supposed to hurt. It is supposed to be difficult, but it most certainly is not supposed to hurt. Love does not hit you. It does not yell at you. It does not take your money. It does not threaten you. So, you know, just, you know, continuously exerting those affirmations of empowerment to anyone that may be experiencing domestic violence.
I do definitely agree. Caller, I thank you so very much for calling and chiming with us and giving your input and, you know, just aiding us in seeing some of the things that we don't possibly look at sometimes because of the different things that we're focused on as far as the topic goes. But it's definitely appreciated you calling in and giving your input.
Thank you, and I've enjoyed the show.
Oh, no problem at all. Thank you, thank you.
All right.
So, Shakira, another showdown.
Another show.
It's always...
I forgot. Let me be clear, because I said I was going to speak on it, and I'm not going to go too much in it, but it does relate. I do just want to say, as my own personal statement, I do stand with my sisters at Spelman University as they address this issue with being supported by their brothers at Morehouse. I stand with women across the world as they address the issue of the kind of normalization of race culture that exists. And, you know, definitely, you know, it kind of relates to domestic violence. It's the same thing, you know, any action in which you are not willingly participating in, nor do you desire, you know, is not one that somebody should force upon you. So I just wanted to say that I had posted it on my Instagram, but I said I was going to say something about it.
Well, and I also just want to bring up and just say that to all those people out there that are possibly victims of domestic violence, just know that you are not alone, that there are many people out there that are truly concerned and willing to do what it takes to better your circumstances and aid you in moving forward by providing those resources that are applicable to your situation and sometimes available to you in those certain situations in respective areas where you do live and things of the sort. The domestic violence hotline number we're going to give out, staffed 24 hours a day by trained counselors who can truly provide crisis assistance and information about different shelters, legal advocacy, healthcare centers, and counseling of the sort, is going to be 1-800-799-SAFE. And that's 1-800-799-7233. And if you truly feel that you are in need of assistance, call 911. I will tell you, you know, domestic violence is truly something that has become a priority and a topic that many law enforcement professionals throughout the country deal with on a day-to-day basis and are trained in. So, and they know of the resources that are immediately available, and there are shelters that are out there, and we have a duty to respond and a duty to aid you in whatever situations and the abilities that we can, that we have. So, don't feel hesitant. Let us know when you are in need, and we will be able to render the resources that we can. So in closing, I'd just like to thank everybody for just tuning in and you know, just becoming a part of the Bruce C. and Shakira experience as we move forward and create a path to just provide people with just our perspective on the real issues and the things that we feel should be discussed. You know, knowledge is truly power, and it gives us the ability to truly be one. Anything from you, Shakira?
No, I know we, because it'll be Wednesday will pass. So I just want to take the time out, especially as we've discussed in domestic violence, to wish all the mothers a happy Mother's Day. I know Sunday's Mother's Day, so I just want to wish all the mothers a happy Mother's Day. A happy Mother's Day to my mom, Carolyn. I love her. So, you know, Happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to Brucey's mom.
Okay. Yeah, happy Mother's Day to my mother as well, Yvonne. I know sometimes she tunes in and chimed in or anything with us just yet, but I'm sure that may be coming up in the future. But as we close, guys, thank you so very much because it's truly helping us out by moving forward and just talking about these things. So until next time, the Brucey and Shikaira Experience.